Welcome to 502 Conversations. I'm Brian Kirby, and my guest today is Dr. Paul Offit. Dr. Offit, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Thanks, Brian.
All right. I have a brief bio on you I'd like to read, and then I want to discuss your book, Overkill. Dr. Offit is professor of pediatrics at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. He is a physician scientist and co-inventor of Rototech, a rotavirus vaccine that is estimated to save hundreds of lives a day. Dr. Offit has published more than 180 papers in medical and scientific journals, is the author of 11 books, and the recipient of many awards and honors. Dr. Offit is a member of VRBPAC, the FDA Vaccines and Related Biological Products Committee, otherwise known as the Vaccine Advisory Committee, I think, and a member of Accelerating COVID-19 Technological Innovations in Vaccines, or ACTIV, which was a group put together by the head of the NIH, Dr. Francis Collins. ACTIV is comprised of industry representatives and representatives from the CDC, FDA, and academia. Dr. Offit, your latest book is Overkill: When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far. And that's what we're going to discuss today. All right, so you kind of run the gamut in this book from well-known, what are thought to be well-known common knowledge type medical things to a more precise medical technology that requires expertise. And so it turns out some of those or neither of those always live up to their expectations. So I want to ask about some of those, but then get really to the heart of the matter, which is how the common Joe and Josephine is supposed to evaluate all this data, which can sometimes seem contradictory. I want to start with something simple. Well, I shouldn't say it's simple, but something that we all think we know about, which are vitamins and vitamin supplements. And you actually have a chapter on vitamin D. And I want to go through a kind of a quick fire first and throw some things out that are thought to be common knowledge and then get what your research shows you. So vitamin D supplements prevent cancer, they prevent strokes and heart attacks, they prevent infectious diseases, they eliminate mood disorders and make me happy, they prevent diabetes, and the most common thing we know is that vitamin D supplements increase bone density and prevent fractures. That's an easy one because that's something we've all heard. Yes, no to any of those.
No to all of them. I think what happened with vitamin D was it was a victim of ecological and observational studies. So an ecological study is when you look at people that live, say, in sunny areas and compare them to people who live in non-sunny areas. And then you say that there are differences in health outcomes in the sunny area as compared to the non-sunny area. And you then make the leap, the unfortunate leap, that it must be because of vitamin D, when there are obviously many other factors to consider or in control for. The second thing are these observational studies, where you look at people who take vitamin D on their own or don't take vitamin D on their own. So the researcher isn't deciding who gets it and who doesn't get it. And again, it showed that vitamin D had a variety of health effects, but what they weren't controlling for were things like smoking and exercise and diet, which was different among these two groups. When they finally did the right studies, which is to say prospective placebo-controlled studies, where the researcher decided who got vitamin D and who didn't randomly, and controlled for things like health-seeking behavior, medical background, socioeconomic background, none of these things were true. And it's too bad because those studies came too late, before this sort of religion of vitamin D had sprung up. And I think doctors are all part of this. I mean, this is an industry. You know, you get vitamin D levels, you prescribe vitamin D, and you're leaning into the teeth of an industry. What surprised me the most was that it didn't make any difference in terms of fractures. I mean, you know, vitamin D helps increase the entrance of calcium from the intestine into the bloodstream. So you would have thought it made a difference, but even that didn't make a difference. So it's largely hoaxical.
Well, vitamin D is something that we can all get our hands on, and you're saying it's hoaxical because it was based on these observation and ecological studies. The word study and research is going to come up a lot, I'm sure, in this conversation, so I'm assuming all studies aren't created equal. What designates a good study from a bad study from just an advertisement?
I think the difference between a good study and a bad study is a good study is extremely well-controlled, so you make sure that the only variable in that study is what you're studying, with receipt of vitamin D, receiving MMR vaccine, whatever it is, that you control for all other variables as best you can to make sure that you can isolate the effect of that one variable, receipt of this medical product. It's hard. You know, there's probably 4,000 articles published a day in the medical and scientific literature, although I think now in COVID-19, it's probably double because there's probably another 4,000 on COVID-19. And I think, you know, they follow a bell-shaped curve, these studies. I mean, some are awful, some are excellent, most are more or less mediocre. And I think it asks a lot of people, and asked a lot, frankly, of doctors to try and distinguish good ones from bad ones. But the good ones are well controlled, and most importantly, reproducible. That other groups working with other populations also find the same thing. Then I think when you see study after study showing that by different groups in different areas, then I think you can say a truth has emerged.
Well, with the vitamin D, I mean, you quote dozens of studies, but the religion, I guess you'll call it that, was based on two studies. So how come a bad study never seems to die?
Well, I think people want the magic medicine. They want to, if they're feeling down, if they're, they're a break in a bone break, or whatever, they want to believe there's something they can take by mouth, a little magic pill that will make this all go away. I think we're very susceptible to that. And as long as we don't hurt ourselves, it doesn't bother me. But, all medicines that you take, anything that has a positive effect can have a negative effect by definition. So you just have to be careful.
All right, let's talk about something more specific. Your book, Overkill, When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far. This is something that, of course, the regular person doesn't have access to. But I don't know if you mentioned this in the book, but we're all familiar with the science fiction doctor of the future. They scan you, they tell you what's wrong, and then they prescribe something and they just zap you. High technology. Mammography is high technology. Over the decades, it's become very refined expertise. They can detect very early suspicious things. What possibly can be wrong with such early detection? Because that's in your book too.
Sure. I think when mammography was introduced in the 1960s, it was a lifesaver. I mean, now you were able to detect early cancers that you hadn't detected before, and you could with either radiation therapy or surgery or chemotherapy, blunt a disease that was going to kill you. What's happened over time is we've gotten much, much better at treating breast cancers. We can define the sort of different markers on the surface of one breast cancer group of cells versus another, and we can target therapies much more specifically. So even if you're diagnosed with fairly middle or late stage cancer, your life is often saved. Therefore, what's happened is the balance has shifted. Now, false positives seem to rule the day. So the people are said to have a cancer that they really don't have, which creates an enormous sort of emotional burden. I think knowing that you think you have a cancer when it turns out subsequent biopsy show that you don't. And so the number of lives saved by breast cancer screening program has dramatically decreased. And I looked also at prostate cancer and thyroid cancer screening programs, which I think are useless. Now we clearly know that prostate cancer screening programs do not save the lives of the American man. I mean, I was at the urologist's office last week and he, wanted to get blood work on me. I said, don't get a PSA level. Don't. I don't want to know. I'm willing to die of prostate cancer, which is not to say that people don't die of prostate cancer or thyroid cancer or breast cancer. Of course they do. The question is whether with this testing, you can pick up who's going to die from the cancer and who isn't. I mean, and we haven't gotten to that point, certainly with prostate and thyroid cancers. What you want to know is if you have a diagnosis of prostate cancer, this is a cancer that if I treat it early, I will save your life. As distinct from this is a cancer that's so aggressive, it doesn't matter what I'm going to do, you're still going to die. Or this is a cancer that you're going to die with and not from. And if you look at prostate cancers, look at people over 85 who die of other reasons, hit by a truck, whatever. 80 to 85% of people over 80 years of age will have prostate cancer. They just died with it, not from it. So we're not good at this. We're not good at this yet. And until we get good at it, I would say forget the prostate cancer and thyroid cancer screening programs. Regarding breast cancer, I sort of go through how to at least think about it, because you could reasonably make the decision to get mammography or not.
Well, let's talk about that reasonable decision or not. If I hear you correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, when mammography was first developed, early detection was great. It saved lives from breast cancer. But now it's gotten so refined that there's just it causes more anxiety? Or how would a woman weigh that? I mean, obviously everybody wants to know early if they have cancer.
Sure. I would make the barnyard analogy, which Gilbert Welch, an oncologist, has made, which imagine a barn in which there are three animals. There's a rabbit, a turtle, and a bird. You open up the barn door and the bird immediately flies out. I mean, that's a cancer that you're going to die from no matter what you do. Then you open up the door and there's the turtle in there. And it doesn't matter how quickly you close the door, the turtle is not going to get out. That's a cancer you're going to die with and not from. Now, we're talking about the rabbit. The rabbit is something where you open the door, you see the rabbit starting to hop to you, you can close the door in time. That's a cancer that if you detect early, you can prevent the person from dying. So that's the question on all these cancers, prostate, thyroid, breast. What is the relative ratio of birds to turtles to rabbits? And the problem with prostate and thyroid cancer screening programs is that mostly, you're detecting a lot of birds and turtles. You want to detect the rabbits. With the breast cancer screening programs, you at least do detect some rabbits. So there's value in it. But that's one way to think about it.
It's one of the things that's recommended yearly, and it's part of the healthcare program. So isn't that evidence right there? I'm sorry.
Well, no, there are advisory committees that advisory committees that don't recommend mammography, or they're recommended certainly at a much older age and much less frequently. I think the purpose of this book is not so that you can become your own doctor. I think that's always dangerous. I think the purpose is so that you can inform yourself, so that when you go to your doctor, you can at least have more information and you can ask better questions. I think that's the point. And it doesn't matter what I say. You sort of alluded earlier to sort of kind of this, the guru phenomenon of the future, but it doesn't matter what I say. The only thing that matters is what the data show. Where is the wealth of evidence? Does the wealth of evidence support the use of vitamin D, support the use of these cancer screening programs or not? And that's it. And so I try and simply go through those studies so people can understand what I think are the best data out there.
All right, well, let's stay on the technology and high expertise, because heart stents also are in the book. That's another thing that's just a fantastic invention. The doctor can thread something into you and take a magic picture and see a blockage, and then they can either inject some medicine or they can dilate it and make your arteries bigger, or a combination of the two. And I know this is semi-recent news, but it's kind of some news that rocked the medical world, I thought, when it turns out that that's like a 50-50. What did you find out about stents?
Yeah, it's interesting. That was the chapter in the book that engendered the most hate mail from doctors. I mean, specifically from cardiologists who basically are making a living off this. I thought the purpose of this book really was for me to sort of alienate the few remaining friends that I had left in this world, really. But, it makes sense, right? You have, let's say you have a heart attack, and that you find out that when you look at one of these two major arteries that supply the heart muscle with blood, that the area beyond where you had the heart attack, where that heart muscle was damaged, is being supplied by an artery which is blocked to some extent, let's say greater than 70% blocked. Doesn't it make sense then to put a stent, a bare metal or drug-eluting stent, into that artery to open it up so that it no longer is blocked? And so therefore, hence the birth of cardiac stenting. And, people believe they benefited from this. So the thing is, most people will have pain, so-called angina, some will have heart attacks, but angina is, or pain in the chest is a subjective phenomenon. It's not like, respiratory rate or blood pressure, which can be measured. Pain is whatever you say it is. So what they did was, and it's amazing to me, they actually could do this study, and they did it in England called the Orbitus study, where what they did was they took people who had a greater than 70% blockage, and they took them to the operating room or the cardiology and interventional suite, and they threaded a needle up through their catheter, up into their vein, up into their coronary artery, and then either put in a stent or didn't. But the person didn't know whether they'd gotten a stent or not. They didn't. They knew that it was possible that they could have one or not have one. And then they did, for both groups that either got a stent or didn't get a stent, they did maximal medical management. Meaning, make sure that their blood pressure was in control, make sure that their high levels of bad cholesterol were in control. So did made sure people exercised, it had right diets, et cetera. Everything medical you could do to try and prevent a subsequent, heart attack or anginal attack. And then look to see whether there's any difference. No difference. No difference in the rate of angina, no difference in the rate of heart attacks. And the reason is that the large heart artery then supplies smaller and smaller heart arteries, which were also blocked. That's why it didn't make a difference whether you opened up that big coronary artery. So now there are cardiology groups like the group at Cleveland Clinic, which doesn't do heart stenting anymore. It's because they believe that study. And heart stenting isn't benign. You can die when you're getting a heart stent. So if you can avoid any sort of surgery, it's of value. But that's the one chapter that got me the most hate mail.
Well, it's so counterintuitive, but it's counter to everything that we hear for so long. That kind of, it doesn't make a difference. Now, and you're talking about people that are suffering from chest pain that go in preemptively. We're not talking about somebody that drops from a heart attack, gets rushed to the hospital. They're not going to argue on the gurney with their doctor that wants to get them into a stent right away. That's a totally different thing. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Let's go back to the regular Joe and Josephine, such as myself. Here's something we all know. A diet rich in fruits and vegetables is good for you. It's cancer preventative, all kinds of cancer preventative, rich in fruits and vegetables. I'm talking about vitamin A and beta carotene, the cabbages, the Brussels sprouts, the onions, leeks, all those kinds of things. They prevent all kinds of different cancers, such as stomach cancer, esophageal cancer, colon cancer. So if that's the case with eating a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, it just makes sense that antioxidant supplements will have the same effect.
It makes perfect sense. It just doesn't happen to be true, but it makes perfect sense, right? I mean, if you look at groups or people that eat diets rich in fruits and vegetables that contain antioxidants, they tend to live longer, have a lower rate of cancer and lower rate of heart disease. So it would make sense then to, if that's true, then why not just eat, take supplemental antioxidants, because you may feel that your diet isn't rich in fruits and vegetables, and this is one way to have one without having to do the other. The problem is that in your body, there is a balance between oxidation and antioxidation. When you process foods, when your cells process foods to become energy, you create free radicals. That process is oxidation. You oxidize your food to generate energy. When you generate free radicals, that's dangerous. I mean, free radicals can damage cell membranes, they can damage DNA. They're probably the major reason that we're not immortal. And so it would make sense then that if you eat diets rich in fruits and vegetables, which have an antioxidant effect, therefore anti-free radical effect, that you can live longer, which is all true. The problem with antioxidants taken supplementally, it's far more than you would normally get, and it's also not presented in the manner in which you would get it, meaning surrounded by these other so-called phytochemicals, which are just vegetable chemicals that it's the normal milieu. It's not a natural thing to do. If you take 1,000 milligram tablet of vitamin C, for example, you would have to eat 14 oranges to get that, or 8 cantaloupes, and that's more than you would normally do. Your stomach is only so big for a reason. So you're doing an unnatural thing. What happens then is you actually move the balance of oxidation and antioxidation too much in favor of antioxidation, and you need oxidation to do things like kill cancer cells, clean clogged arteries. So that's the problem with that. And I think people don't understand that. I give the industry credit for being able to sell this as a natural thing to do when it's an incredibly unnatural thing to do. The vitamin E story is probably the clearest. I mean, there are 5 studies that clearly show that if you take large doses of vitamin E, like what typically are the so-called mega vitamin E, where you would have to eat roughly 1,700 almonds, which are rich in vitamin E, to get that same thing you're getting in that one little gel cap, that you increase your risk of prostate cancer. I mean, study after study has shown this. If this were a regulated industry, meaning regulated by the FDA, if the GNC Center was regulated by the FDA, vitamin E, mega doses of vitamin E would have a black box warning on them saying, realize that this product increases your risk of prostate cancer. But it's an unregulated industry, so you don't see it.
You can sympathize with me, the average Joe, and all this conflicting information. And I think it's in your book that the vitamin or the supplement companies just say, we'll wait out the science and just do more marketing, more advertising, because, you know, the science will fade. We can advertise and still be number one. So that's what I see, right? I don't see these studies. Doctors do have access to these studies. They may not have time to look at them all, but I'm sure you get together in groups. Well, I'm not sure, but maybe you get together in groups and talk about things. One of the odd things I read in your book was sometimes a doctor will say, we don't need a study because I've been doing it for 40 years. I know it works. Is that a if you've been doing something for 40 years so you know it works, is that a legitimate opinion? be careful here. I don't want you to get any more hate mail.
medicine evolves. We learn as we go. I think that the beauty of science is that we can throw a textbook over our shoulder without a backward glance as we get more and more information. That can be disconcerting for some people who sort of prefer the guru. I mean, the Mehmet Oz, the Deepak Chopra, Andrew Wakefield, who simply say, this is true. I know this is true. I don't care what the data show. I know this is true. So I think what works, what's working here that makes us less willing to move forward as scientific information becomes available and clearer is one, what you just said. I've been doing this way for years and it seems to work. That's not exactly a scientifically based statement. So that's one, because doctors want to help people. They want to believe they've been helping people. And if you just tell them, well, really everything you've just been doing is not science based, they're going to be bristle at that. I think the second thing is the patient really grades the doctor. So doctors in many ways have become more like waiters in a restaurant than doctors in a clinic. It's sort of like you do what in some ways the patient wants you to do. That's why antibiotic prescriptions are written so frequently for viral infections, because the patient wants an antibiotic prescription and they'll rate the doctor more highly if they get one. So I think, we tend to be more interested in pleasing the patient than necessarily helping them through this dense thicket of medical information. And I think it's in some ways not, it is hard to keep up. I mean, there are many articles published published every day, and doctors can't keep up on all things. So I think that's another reason. So all those sort of at some level work against the patient.
Now, let me ask you a personal question, because you are a pediatrician. You went through medical school. I'm sure when you got out, you were very confident with all the answers. What's something that, and I don't mean that flippantly, I mean, I hope you came out confident, but what's something that happened in your life where you said, geez, I've been wrong? You looked at the data and said, this has been wrong. I've been wrong all this time. Has it happened to you personally?
Sure. Well, first of all, I don't know how confident I came out. I think what medical school, there were three physicians, Ted Woodward, John Diaconis, and Ellen Wald, who were really skeptical. They drilled into the head of me and my fellow medical students the notion that although you're going to be told that this is the way to practice medicine, that this is the thing to do, be skeptical of every bit of it and make sure that you can find the data that shows that that is true. They were great about that. I mean, they went through a series of things that we assumed were facts and told us with how flimsy the evidence that fact was based on. So I think I was sort of been skeptical really ever since the beginning. And I think it's served me well. I mean, I can tell you, when I was a pediatric resident at Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh, we were taught that children who had febrile seizures, which is usually a short 30-second to 1-minute seizure associated with a rapid rise in temperature, usually happens to children between 2 and 5 years of age, that you should treat that with phenobarbital. That was a terrible idea. It lasted for years before doctors finally realized that febrile seizures are benign, that phenobarbital isn't, and you're doing far more harm than good. And that's just one of many things. We used to be told to make sure that when children went to sleep after they just eaten it, they lay on their stomach, right? So that in case they vomited, they didn't regurgitate it. Well, that was a bad idea. I mean, that increased the risk of sudden infant death syndrome until the American Academy of Pediatrics in the early 1990s, which was after I trained, you know, had their so-called back to sleep program, meaning put children on their back, and with that, the incidence of sudden infant death syndrome dramatically declined. So this is one of many or two of many things that I learned as absolute fact that was dead wrong.
Your book is Overkill: When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far. It's an accessible read. There's a lot of information about studies and how they work. And I think there must be, 15 or 19 chapters on things that were thought to be true, but then subsequently turned out not to be so true. Was there anything in the book that surprised you?
I think the thing that surprised me the most was the icing sprain story. That I assumed that when you sprained your ankle or sprained your knee, that icing made you feel better and therefore was better. I mean, there are now studies showing that when you have pain because there's increased blood flow to the area. And so that's a good thing. And that brings sort of healing factors to that area. The thing, although I would say the thing that ultimately surprised me the most, although I'm an infectious disease doctor, so it shouldn't have, is don't finish the antibiotic course. Once you start to feel better, once your immune system abates, that the bacteria that you're trying to kill have been killed. And so you don't need to assign a specific length of therapy at the beginning of illness. You don't need that. We don't do that for pain. We don't do that for asthma. Why are we doing it for this? And so now you're starting to see we're backing off on the length of time that we treat these bacterial infections. When I talk to people about this book, that's the thing that surprises them the most. Wait, you don't need to finish the antibiotic course? This is like, telling them something that seems to say that, the earth isn't round.
Well, you can also, with icing a sprain or a seizure, I mean, people want to do something. They want to act. They don't want to just wait it out. So some of the activity has to come from that. Just, I have a fever. I want to take a fever reducer. I have a sprain. I want to ice it. My kid has a seizure. We have to do something. That's not something that people can just calmly sit by and say, oh, that's going to pass.
No, I think you're right. But sometimes doing nothing is doing something. I mean, if you take the fever example, why do we all have fever? Why is it that everything can walk, fly, swim, or crawl on the face of this planet induces fever? And the reason is your immune system works better at a higher temperature. Your B cells make antibodies more efficiently. Your neutrophils or white blood cells travel to areas of bacterial infection and kill bacteria more efficiently. And study after study has shown if you treat fever, you actually prolong and worsen illness. It could not be clearer. And similarly, before you get a vaccine, when you get a vaccine, if you're taking anti-fever medicines, you blunt the immune response. So it could not be clearer. Yet we still do it. We still do it because it's not fun having fever, because you have headaches and chills and muscle aches when you have fever. And so we think we're doing something when we're not. And sometimes doing nothing is doing something. And I think we just have to realize that.
All right, Dr. Paul Offit, thank you very much. The new book is Overkill: When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far. Like I said, it's a great read. It's very accessible. And then also it points you in other directions. Now, let me ask one other question. Any ideas for another book? And is there any chance it'll be what we thought was wrong is actually good for us? Like eat more hot fudge sundaes or something like that? Can you?
Yeah. And that Woody Allen line that he goes into the future, he realizes all these things people said were good for you, were bad for you, you know, like milk in college.
Yeah, right. So wheat germ.
I'm interested in a book. So something like with the title of something like The Learning Curve, kind of making medical decisions in an age of uncertainty. I think we're sort of seeing that now with the COVID-19 vaccines and with hydroxychloroquine. I mean, how do you make decisions under uncertainty? So what I'd like to do is sort of go through kind of the 9 most important medical advances, you know, antibiotics or vaccines or gene therapies, et cetera, and talk about how tragedy leads to triumph. But was there a way to avoid those tragedies? Because I think that's what we're dealing with now. We're about to do this, you know, sort of massive vaccine program with vaccines for which there's no commercial experience, and we have a virus which is elusive and difficult to characterize. I'm sure that in the next 2 years we're going to learn things we wish we knew now. And so that's it. It's sort of use these 9 stories as exercises in how to make decisions under uncertainty.
All right, Dr. Offutt, I look forward to reading that book. I'm Brian Kirby. This has been 502 Conversations, and my guest has been Dr. Paul Offutt and his book Overkill: When Modern Medicine Goes Too Far. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian. That was fun. We managed to spend a whole half an hour without ever really talking about SARS-CoV-2. Amazing.
It sort of came up at the end, and the only thing that I could summarize that with is, you know, uncertainty. I mean, that we have all this data always coming at us and contradictory. What are we to do? So that's something you can figure out and let me know.
I will. All right. Thanks. I'll talk to you later.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.